This is the Road to Shambhala podcast. I am your host, Sam Dingman, and we're broadcasting live from Stuck Between Studios right here in Brooklyn, New York. How's everybody doing? So good to have you back with us this week. I hope you tuned in last week for our last special edition, which was an all music episode. This week, another special edition. This is a theater panel, which I conducted recently with the artistic directors of Wide Eyed Productions, Ms. Kristen Skye Hoffman, the co-artistic director of Stolen Chair Theater Company, Mr. John Stancato, and the artistic director of Flux Theater Ensemble, Mr. Gus Schulenberg. Three more intelligent, ambitious artists you could not hope to meet, and all three of their theater companies are working at very high levels in the off-Broadway scene here in New York City. So if you like theater, this is the episode for you. We'll get right to the discussion now on The Road to Shambhala. I am here with our panel of theatrical experts. We have another segment on the show with our panel of distinguished experts who are distinguished in general fields, which I'm sure all of you guys are too. But in particular, today we're going to be talking about theater. I am here with Kristen Skye Hoffman.
Hi.
John Stancato.
Hello again.
And Gus Schulenberg.
That's me.
Now, my friends, people are going to think that it is a prerequisite to be on this program to be selected among NewYorkTheater.com's People of the Year.
It should be.
Because that is an honor that all three of you share. Stolen Chair in 2005,
yeah.
Flux in 2008, and Kristen, newly crowned in 2009.
Congrats.
Thank you. Yay. And
so,
to you.
Congratulations to all of you. I thought by way of introducing each of yourselves a little bit, something that might be fun is that all of your guys' theater companies have extremely compelling names. So
that's
I thought
good.
Maybe we could go around and you guys could all talk about where the names of the companies come from.
Okay.
Kristen, if you'd like to start.
Well, it's funny. We Liz White and Sky Seals and we are the three co-founders of White Eyed Productions. And we sat at a diner one day and decided we were going to make our theater company happen with a show that we'd already rehearsed. But we all knew that we had different ideas. And so we all went home. And when I got to my house, I sat in quiet and I thought, we need like an image. What do we want to make people see? And I was like, oh, that's exactly what it is. It's an eye. It's something that's eyes. It's wide-eyed. It's a child looking at something for the first time, or it's really scary and you can't shut your eyes, or you're right at the edge of your seat because it's so compelling and your eyes won't shut. And so it immediately brings up an image. Mm-hmm. And so it was easy to come up with a logo.
Yep.
And when I brought it back to them, they all just immediately said, that's exactly perfect, because that's really what we want, is that passion and that drive and that awe factor. And so wide-eyed made sense. And we also knew that we wanted to do lots of different types of theater, and it made sense for lots of different types of theater, children's theater, scary Grecian dramas, mm-hmm. and, you know, funny stuff too. You know, if, as long as you want to look at it wide-eyed, you know, so
cool.
It made sense.
Cool.
Yeah.
John?
Yeah, so Sam, you might remember.
I admittedly know this story.
So, full disclosure, Sam was among the founding members of Stolen Chair back in 2002.
It is true.
After we decided we were starting a theater company, the major challenge became, again, like what Kristen was saying, the name. And so we were looking at everything around and trying to make that a theater company name. We were around candles. And it was, how about the candle company? How about the microphone company? And we just kept tossing out very, very stupid names. And then we were sitting in theater history seminar. This is back when the co-founder and I were in undergrad at Swarthmore College. And we were watching a movie by Ariane Mnouchkine about the life and work of Jean-Baptiste Poquelin Molière. And so Molière runs away from the career he's supposed to have, which is to take on his father's mantle as the court upholsterer to Louis XIV. Mm. And instead he runs off and starts a theater company. And his father sort of disowns him, bans him from returning to the house. And after his theater company has been started, we cut to like a few months into the future, and it's night, and we see Jean-Baptiste coming down the stairway of his father's house, and his father comes out and says, "Jean-Baptiste, what are you doing with that chair?" Because Molière is holding this big jewel-studded throne that he's stolen from his dad. And he says, "I'm sorry, Dad, we need it for Act 3," or something of that ilk. And as a theater company sort of dedicated to supporting the voice of an emerging American female playwright, Molière has always sort of made sense as a patron saint for our company and the nature of our collaboration and to a lesser degree, our certain Commedia inspirations that we bring into our work. And so that's always sort of made sense to us. And then as our mission came to be evolving over the years, we also realize that we steal a lot. We steal from any discipline we can. We steal from other people's work. We steal from theater history. And so theft makes a lot of sense for the work we do. And for that first show we did together back in 2002, we did steal three chairs.
Yeah, and I was just going to say.
So it works on both literal, metaphorical, and sort of spiritual, inspirational levels for us as a company.
That's a much more romantic story, and I love it.
Well, I've had a few more years to embellish it.
A few more grant applications
we
to fill out.
It would be neat, so we named it Wide-Eyed.
Also, only the artistic director of an independent theater company would be able to say Molière's full name.
I made a pilgrimage to his tomb this past summer. He didn't know that, though. So.
Did you steal anything from?
You know, there wasn't much around besides twigs and tourists, so I passed.
And Gus, where does Flux come from?
Well, you know, Flux is a good word.
Yes.
It's got a lot of meanings, and a lot of them suit us, because we're a very conflicted company with a lot of contrary parts. And, you know, the idea of change is something that's really exciting to us. You can never step in the same river twice, and our work is really involved with those moments when something changes in a human being, and then how that very personal change echoes out into the wider world. But flux can also be something that joins things together. It's a term in metallurgy. That's a fun one. And so it's sort of a great idea that this idea that everything is constantly changing can actually bring things together and form a more cohesive bond. And it can also mean waste and detritus. So, you know, before we get too full of ourselves, it's good to think of all the meanings of that particular word.
Absolutely.
But none of those things are why we actually chose the name. We actually chose the name because after we had first done a show together, and it was a really, really difficult process, we decided to make a theater company anyway. And one of our founders, Jason Paradine, was sort of advocating for not rushing to name the company too early, you know, because we were in such a state of flux. And when he said that, you know, it was one of those little electric ripples went through the room. I feel like his voice actually deepened a couple octaves as he said it. And, you know, we all turned and looked at each other, and sad to say, it was that simple.
That's why I wanted to ask all you guys about that, because, I mean, the next question that I have is, why start a company? So it's cool to hear about the moment at which the identity of the group that you were going to be putting countless hours into kind of crystallized. So why start a company?
A really good question. For me, I actually met Jared Bogard, our resident playwright, and he had a bunch of projects, and I started directing those projects, and we started building this pool of actors and all these really amazing people, and they kept wanting to work with us again and again and again, and that was wonderful, but there was this common thread between all of us, which was that we were so tired of doing shows out here that we weren't proud to invite people to. I had been hired by the Hudson Shakespeare Company to direct Medea for them. Mm-hmm. And I had just cast it with all these great people that I loved that I'd worked with 100 times. And it turned into this really beautiful piece of theater. And we were all so proud of it. But the way Hudson Shakespeare works is they do 6 shows a year, which is amazing, but they only get a few runs. And we were the very last show of the season, so we only got 5 runs instead of 10. And we one of them got rained out. So we only got to perform it four times. One was in New York. So maybe 30 people saw this beautiful piece of theater that we created. And Liz White was cast in it. And Sky Seals was cast in it. And when it ended, I hoofed around and I found a theater, the Richmond Shepherd Theater, which who didn't make us give him a deposit. He said, no, I trust you. And I was like, why? And he goes, I just trust you. And I said, well, you're starting a theater company, so thank you. He let us pay for our rent with the ticket sales.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was really unheard of. Yeah. And we put up this show. I said, hey, Liz and Sky, remember how we always talk about starting a theater company? I think that this is what we should do. I think that this is the inaugural production. And they said, yes, absolutely. And so that's really how it started. And somehow we ended up in the black, which was amazing. And so,
nice.
Yeah. And so that was really why. And mm-hmm. it's been going ever since, which is great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Guys.
So Stolen Chair developed as Kieran Rickey, who is the co-artistic director of the company.
And the aforementioned emerging female playwright.
Yes, exactly. We were undergrads at Swarthmore College, and Swarthmore is a very, very special sort of undergraduate theater education, insofar as you learn practically nothing that will be very useful in the theater business. I know Sam was considering Tisch versus Swarthmore at one point. And I think he emerged with a very different set of skills from Swarthmore. What you do learn, and you learn well, is how to create collaborative theater. Mm-hmm. In part, that's the presence of Pig Iron Theater Company sort of in the faculty and sort of always around. And in part, that's the fact that the Theater History Seminar, for example, is organized around the work of Théâtre du Soleil out in Paris. And so you really have these very, very strong persuasive models for success via a theater company. And after a year, our junior year, when Kieran, Ricky, and I were the only two directors in the directing class, we had sort of grown artistically codependent, and she said, we should probably start a theater company. This was the only way we knew to create theater. And I said yes, and then we dealt with the repercussions of that for the subsequent 9 years and continue to be doing so. I remember, I think it's in one of Anne Bogart's books, or she certainly says in a lot of her interviews and speaking gigs, that she went to go see a Théâtre du Soleil piece, and she wandered around the house during the cast party to try to find Ariane Mnouchkine, and she was asking Ariane Mnouchkine for advice, saying, I want to make theater, what should I do? And Mnouchkine said very, very brusquely and curtly, well, you have to start a company. It's the only way. And I know that I like the fact, I haven't directed anything else in New York besides my work with Stolen Chair. The 12 productions I've done with Stolen Chair have been the extent of it. Kieran Rickey hasn't written any plays that haven't been produced by Stolen Chair. And so
that's kind of amazing. Yeah. I love that.
It's really comforting to know that that though we have to scramble for many of the things that all independent theater companies have to scramble for, we don't have to scramble for the opportunity to present our work. Mm-hmm. It's always available. Yeah. And over the years, we've been able to surround ourselves with some really incredible collaborators, and many of them have wanted a sort of greater investment and stake in the company and have come in as full members. And it's really been a family, and I see why Mnouchkine advised Bogart to go that way.
It's absolutely true.
I tell many people that if I wasn't directing for Stolen Chair, I wouldn't be directing. I don't have a skill set to direct plays. I have a skill set to direct Kieran Rickey's plays, and and I like that, and I'm proud of that. But if you handed me a Neil Simon, I don't know what I'd do with. So this is the way I'm going to make theater, and then I'm very, very pleased with our decision back in 2001.
Back in 2005, I had an opportunity by a theater company in the city. They gave me a space and they gave me some money. And the way this company worked is you basically had free reign to produce what you wanted. And so this was the second time that I had done that. But this was a much bigger play. It was about 20 characters. It was this crazy neo-Shakespearean thing. And so I knew I needed some help. So I brought in six people from different parts of my life. Only one of them had I gone to school with, which I think is feels unique to me about Flux, but maybe not, and that we don't share a lot of training.
No, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that is one of those things when you go and see things, especially in the off-Broadway community, and you look through the program, you start to be like, oh, everybody went to Oberlin or whatever, you know. So that is, I mean, I think that is unique.
Yeah. Well, and the process of making this particular play was extremely difficult, and really broke down everyone who was involved. But the seven people who were at the core of it just never stopped. They never gave up. And, you know, we're talking sleeping at the theater for 2 weeks straight to deal with the challenges that came out of this production. And so out of sort of gratitude and love, I just knew I wanted to keep working with them. But, you know, the thing about that kind of love is it's a great motivator. It's a powerful driving force. But the more clarity that is introduced to love, the more difficult love becomes in any of our relationships, you know. And as we've evolved as a company and been forced to sort of really clarify what our values are and what our aesthetics are, that sort of initial bond of love has been put under strain as we're revealed to be actually quite different people with mm-hmm. quite different agendas and what we want out of theater.
Mm-hmm.
What I hope is that we will emerge stronger from those conflicts. I think thus far we have.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, any ensemble is an incredibly delicate thing. And changing one person, you know, in or out, fundamentally alters the kind of work that you do, you know.
Yeah.
So in a way, you know, you asked a question of when the company crystallized. I mean, I think it hasn't stopped doing that, you
right.
know.
Yes. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
been a sort of series of shocks where you become aware you are now this thing that you weren't before.
The aforementioned state of flux.
Yeah, yeah. I think
luckily
so.
It's built into your name.
Yeah, well, so we have to. But I think what's also been really, really great for us too is that there's sort of been circles emanating out of that core that we've become responsible to. You know, we have a weekly workshop process that involves about 100 different artists in and out over a year. And the work that we create there takes many different public forms that we share with our audience. And so I feel like we've developed a core group of people who either participate in the work or come see everything that we do. And so now the equation has changed again. You know, it's not just about the artists that are a part of the ensemble, but they're this audience that we're responsible to. And that's exciting and daunting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, all of us are trying to figure out what that relationship means now at a time when attendance for all of the arts is just dropping nationwide.
Right.
You know, there's this new study that the NEA released where it's just dropping. And so I think that we need to figure out why that relationship is important to us, why it's important to them, and then find a way to grow that into something that's sustainable.
Yeah. Well, seems like an ideal segue to talk about Stolen Chair's community supported theater project.
Yeah.
John, you want to talk a little bit about how Stolen Chair is addressing that?
Sure. So Stolen Chair, without going into any details of our mission and anything like that, I'll just say that every single new original work that we create is in a dramatically different aesthetic and is wrestling with a dramatically different set of themes to the degree that from piece to piece, it can be an almost unrecognizable company, except for the fact that the creative team stays the same. And on a good day, it means that we're praised for our versatility. On a bad day, it means that we have the potential to alienate people who, for example, when we did our live silent film for the stage, The Man Who Laughs, people were moved, they were touched, and then we presented a bawdy, gender-bent comedy in blank verse. And the people who thought of us as the live silent film theater company were really disappointed.
Yeah.
And so we have this issue as a company in which we have basically three audiences. We have the audiences that are there to support the given creative team, which is fairly stable, but does undergo some flux from show to show. We have the audience that is there because they're interested in whether it's a live silent film or gender-bent comedy in blank verse, a live film noir, a vaudeville, whatever the style it is we're doing or the topic, they're interested in that. And then we have the group that became really, really interested in developing and courting, which is the group who just like us, the ones who just like what Stolen Chair does. And even though they might have favorites among our productions, they are always really, really excited by how we approach the work. And they know the set of surprises and challenges that they're in for a Stolen Chair show. So we set about to figure out how we can develop this. And luckily, about the same time as we were dealing with this crisis as a company, how do we develop the only audience we care about? We saw a call for proposals from The Field, which had just launched a program called Economic Revitalization for Performing Artists. And they were looking for entrepreneurial artistic ideas. And so we submitted created an idea based upon my experience as a member of community-supported agriculture, which is a system in which a core group of members invest seed money at the start of the growing season into a farm, and the farmers use that money to buy seeds and other things. And then over the course of the harvest season, you get a weekly share of the produce that the farmer has harvested. And it was this really sort of incredible community that really turned me on to the process of food creation instead of just the product. And I thought, hey, that's what we're about. And so I hatched evil plans to adapt the business model of community-supported agriculture to the performing arts, and we launched the idea of community-supported theater. And after a year of a research and development grant from the Economic Revitalization Program, we received a $20,000 implementation grant this past September, and in mid-November, we launched the country's first community-supported theater, which basically the basic program is that a small group of members, I think we have something like 35 members.
That's fantastic.
It's and we're not done yet. Hopefully, we want to get to 50 in the next 2 weeks. But yeah. A small group of members invest seed money in Stolinger's process at the beginning of our creative season. And then over the course of the next 8 months, 9 months, they watch as we develop a world premiere original work. And they're seeing every single stage of the process. They're reading what we read. They're watching the videos we watch. They're going to see the events that inspire us. And so we're building a community around our process. And when we finally produce our newest work, which is Quantum Poetics, a science experiment for the stage in June 2010, there will be a group of at least 35 people who have been with us every step of the way and know exactly what we're trying to do. And they could bring their friends in, and it seemed like the best way to sort of find a way to engage a particular invested set of audience members.
Yeah.
And we've had 2 meetups with our members so far, and it's been incredible. We posted we're calling it a script doodle because it's not quite a draft or an excerpt yet. but we have our own private social network for the members of our community-supported theater. And we posted a script doodle, some textual thoughts that Kieran was thinking about in terms of our newest piece. And one of the CST members responded a few hours later with his own script doodle in response.
Oh, great.
And so it seems like our members really get the idea of how Stolen Chair works, how we sort of feed the pot and create as many different ideas for Kieran to work with as possible. And it's obviously still in progress, and we're figuring out how to do this as well as possible. But it's really, really exciting to have these people here who are who know us and are really excited to go behind the scenes with us and see how we make the work and help us make the work and know everything about how we make the work. And so it's thrilling. And little plug, if you want to sign up, we are accepting memberships until the new year. And the website to find out more is www.communitysupportedtheater.org. And you could use whatever spelling of theater you like, either RE or
nice.
ER. You can even slide in a .com instead of the .org if you're really, really adventurous.
Clevowek.
This is our pilot season, and we imagine there's going to be some trial and error, but nytheater.com has embedded a reporter in with our membership. So there's going to be somebody chronicling our going-ons for the outside world. And we have a really excellent documentary filmographer who's been taping all of our meetups, and she's going to be doing a documentary about hopefully the rise of CST, not the fall, just,
right.
just the rise. And we're really excited to have these materials on hand as we try to branch out into our next season come the following August.
Cool.
Thanks for letting me spiel on this.
Oh, no, totally, totally.
Such a great idea.
Yeah. Well, it's cool because, in a way, it makes it so that, your audience members get to do everything. It's like they get all the joys of being in the company, but they don't have to come to rehearsal and they don't have to perform the play. Which is, I think, what a lot of people are into theater for that reason, I think.
Yeah. And we get the thrill of, we have a creative process, which is at least 6 months long, and we've decided to extend it and make sure that we're spending at least 8 months to a year developing each new work before we premiere it for the general public. And it could be hard to disappear into the studio for 8 months without having contact with audience members. And so now we have it every month.
Right.
And they understand that they're not going to be seeing finished product. In fact, they're more excited about the fact that they're not going to be seeing finished product. So we get the privilege of this feedback and this connection and this intimacy, and we don't have to sort of stay in the insular studio. We can continue to reach out and build relationships as we're building new work.
Yeah. Well, and just to go back to the idea of, you know, building a special core of people to work with, I think that's another reason that having a company can be so important. And because, you know, a lot of times if you're, I would imagine, looking to work with New York actors in general, if you say to them, we're going to be spending 8 months to a year building this piece, and we're not really sure when it's going to be performed or what shape it will ultimately take. But it's more about the process, really. So want to try out, you know, you're sort of run of the mill New York actor who is looking for a bulletin to send to their network of casting directors. Not that there's anything wrong with that, is going to shy away from that. Yeah, so, that's just another reason that it's important to have such a core group of people. So Kristen and Gus, do you guys have, I know you guys, your companies haven't been around quite as long as Stolen Chair, but do you have a sense of who your, like what the average wide-eyed audience member looks like, or what the average Flux audience member looks like, or is seeking when they come to see your stuff, and how do you try to reach out to them directly?
Well, we have a number of ways. We have our core group of five members, and then six more members, and then we have that group of around 100 people that participate in the work that we make. And that is this weekly workshop where the playwrights, directors, actors get together and the directors stage scenes that the playwrights have been writing. Then we take some of those scenes that we're particularly excited about, and we bring them to a bar, Jimmy's Number 43, which probably a lot of people are hearing this podcast. Yes.
Oh yeah,
know all about it.
That's where they have that's where they do the burlesque also.
Yeah,
right?
I've produced a monthly burlesque.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's great for it, you know, because it's really intimate, and again, it's about sharing our process, which is a little bit less focused than Stolen Chairs. You know, at any time we're going to be working on, you know, 10 to 15 different plays a month, which is a lot. Yeah. But really exciting for us, and I think for the way that we work. And so we get to share some of those scenes with the audience and get their feedback. And that series is called Have Another. Then if there's a play that we're particularly excited about and we want to develop a little bit more substantially, we have a program called Food Soul, which is a potluck play reading series. And that's really all about giving the play the full 20 hours of workshopping that you can give under the showcase guidelines and equity guidelines. And,
oh, there are guidelines?
I'm yes.
Speaking of New York actors.
Right. Pretend that they're not there.
And then we cook for people. We all cook, and people come and they eat the food that we make and they see the theater that we're making. So again, you know, with both alcohol and with food, it's a way of sort of making theater a part of the more communal activities that we associate with meeting people. And so then we have one other project that we do, which is called Foreplay. And this is when we have a full production. We'll often ask our artists, the artists who surround the company but aren't necessarily involved with the full production, to sort of riff on it. When we did Pretty Theft by Adam Simkowitz in the spring of this year, we did something called Poetic Larceny. And in that, we asked 16 playwrights to write a short play, and the following playwright would steal 3 to 4 things from that, the playwright preceding, because this was a play all about theft. Mm-hmm. And it was really great because the work that these playwrights were doing was dealing with some of the same themes that the play was doing. And I think it not only enhanced the experience of the audience members who came to Poetic Larceny and then came to see the full production, but it enhanced the process of the artists actually working on the play.
Yeah.
So it's in all the things we do, we try to practice sort of the inclusiveness of process that I think John is talking about. And the latest thing we've been doing is really trying to create a feedback loop about the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we have a blog, as many do. But for our most...
You're more prolific than many.
We try to stay busy. Our most recent production, The Lesser Seductions of History, we really actively solicited feedback. And we got a good deal of feedback. And it was really surprising how specific it was and detailed it was. How it was willing to accept the value of the show while at the same time talk candidly about what didn't work for that particular audience member.
Yeah.
And that was great. You know, I think that the kind of stuff that John is doing with CST is really those are the kinds of companies that are going to thrive, you know, because with social media and with everything is just so much more about building a community and about connection that if you're really just presenting a product once or twice a year, well, there's 100 other people that are doing that.
Right.
You know, but if you're asking more of the audience, if you're asking them to engage, I think that's what people are looking for. Or at least the audience that's going to like our work. That's
that
what
kind
they're
of
looking for.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
You know, there are going to be people who just aren't into it. You know, they just right. want to come see a show and laugh and, yeah. you know, and not think about things. But the kind of work that we do needs the kind of audience member who's going to be engaged and who's going to want to talk about it afterwards and who's going to want to be a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So we are deeply invested in the kind of audience engagement that John is talking about, and the conceptual framework that he's given Stolen Chairs is a real inspiration. And I know that part of the money that you've received for this grant is in creating a model that can help other companies learn from the work that they're doing. So it's a really generous thing that they're working on.
I think one of the main differences between Wide Eyed and Flux and Stolen Chair is that we don't do only original pieces. Mm-hmm. We try a lot. We depend a lot on our members. A lot of people ask what our niche is and what it is that what's Wide Eyed's thing that they do, you know? And really what it is we take on these passion projects from people who come to us, different artists, whether they're members or not, and say, I really want to make this happen. And I've seen Wide Eyed's work, and I really want to have that level of quality for this thing that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we're gaining an audience. People bring us proposals, and the board reads every proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And from the proposal, they read the plays. Whether it's an original piece or it's David Lindsay Abaire or Shakespeare or whatever, we read it thinking about what the proposal brought to us was. We think about how it would benefit our members to be a part of it. We think about how much we like the person that is going to that brought it to us, and how much we respect and want to work with them, and they make a great impression on us, and that kind of thing. Then I get all the feedback from the board, and from the board. The board feedback, I create 3 or 4 different options for a season.
Mm-hmm.
Then the board votes on the season.
Gotcha.
So there's a different combination of whatever we think we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority wins.
Yeah.
And because of that, people feel within the company feel really hands-on, and they feel like they're getting an opportunity, and we're choosing shows that they will be good in. We're just now, as we move into our third season, we've discovered different ways to get audience feedback and to try to make sure we're giving people what they want, because with every season we're building new audience members, which is wonderful, but we definitely don't have this is the type of thing our audience will like.
Right.
And we need that. We absolutely do. We're just figuring out how to do it. And mm-hmm. this is so fascinating from you two. It's so, I love it. I'm going to listen to this podcast 100 times.
Kristen, furiously taking mental notes.
I know, really. And so one thing we do is we have a Dark Knight series. It's how we supplement our rent when we are mm-hmm. in, when we're in any kind of exclusive contract for a venue.
Right.
When we aren't performing our main stage show, we have one-man shows, we have staged readings,
yep.
we have we have improv groups and open mic nights and all kinds of different things. And the thing that I think is the most interesting, our second show of the season is going to be Noah's Arkansas by our resident playwright, Jared Bogard. And we held a staged reading of that. And the way our staged readings go is after they're over, we invite the audience to stay and do a talk back and tell us where we lost you, and what part did you love, and what did you get from it, just to make sure that we're going in the right direction. And this, I think for Judas, we have 4 staged readings planned with different playwrights that aren't members of the company
mm-hmm.
that came to us and said, we really want to do this, because they get to do it for no rent. And then we split the door.
Yeah,
and so it helps us supplement. It gets them some money. They mm-hmm. get feedback. And now we're producing the full-on production because mm-hmm. we had a chance to see how people would respond and see if the people would come back and see it again yeah. when it's fully done. And that's really important to us.
So it sounds like something that you guys are doing, which sounds really smart for a younger company, is you're reaching out as much to fellow artists
oh, yeah.
as you are to
that's our audience.
Members. Right.
That's kind mm-hmm. of our audience. And I know that I'm sure you experienced this too, both of you. The people who come to see our shows are 80% people who are friends or colleagues
right,
of
right.
the people that are in the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And we want the new people. We want people who go to Broadway. We want people
right,
who,
right.
who, but it's very difficult because it's such a saturated, it's there's so many,
or,
yeah, there's so many teeny little indie theater companies.
Absolutely.
And it goes back to that, what I was talking about earlier, which is that there are lots of bad productions
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people won't take the risk. I read a book called Creating the Successful Theater Company or something mm-hmm. like that. And they said,
who dare write that book?
But it's really a great book. It's
New York Times bestseller list.
It's
right?
an analysis of all these different companies. Like they talk about Steppenwolf and, you know, all these different companies and how they got started and how they maintained. And it's interesting. Nothing can be the same as any of them, but it's really interesting. And what they said was most theater companies close after the first show.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who get past the first show, they close after 4 years. That's mm-hmm. the average.
Yeah.
And so if you can get past 4 years, you're on your way. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. It is funny, though, now that we're going into our eighth season, we find that there aren't that many companies in New York that we can sort of look to as models to
right.
say, okay, this is where we should be in year eight
right.
Based on where, because there are fewer of them.
Nobody
and
else is in year
those
eight.
Those that yeah. are, a lot of them are companies like Labyrinth and, you know,
that
they,
right. so
they've
much.
Had, let's say, a catalyst that is somehow different than the ones that we have access to. And
right.
so
yeah.
I think, again, that was something that really drove us towards this community support theater model is that we knew that sort of self-producing infinitely wasn't going to help us gain the sustainability necessary to gradually transform from an organization into an institution. And so trying to build up this alternative way of sharing our work with the theater going public seemed like the not only an appealing way for us to do it, but kind of the only way that we could continue to
right.
produce professionally. It's one thing if we wanted to be unpaid amateurs forever,
right.
and we have been for a long time. But 2-3 years ago, when we made a commitment to start paying people for their work, it's a whole different ballgame in terms of the amount of money that we need to raise just to pay people badly.
Mm-hmm.
And right. so if we're going to continue to think about doing that, we needed to have this alternative revenue stream, at least until Philip Seymour Hoffman becomes artistic director of our company.
Right, yeah. How's that going, by the way?
I haven't even gotten it.
Yeah. His people, you know, they don't pick up the phone when you call. It's terrible.
I do know that despite the fact that this is our new initiative is called Community Supported Theater, it grows out of my desire to actually make Stolen Chair a product that people want to consume. I'm sick
right.
of... and we do it. We have a robust individual giving campaign. But no, we ask people for money. We ask governments for money. We ask foundations for money. We ask people for money. I think the best way to illustrate it is this year the DCA, as part of a sort of general philosophical change, made it sort of prerequisite for funding that you were actually doing some sort of community engagement with your work. And this was before we launched CST. So after a year of DCA support, we actually did not get it renewed. And I kind of think that making theater itself is community engagement. And
mm-hmm.
so the idea that that we need to have a social need that we're addressing beyond the fact that we make theater is very, very problematic. But I know that as co-artistic director of the company, I wanted to stop having to ask people to support me and instead offer them something that they wanted. And
right.
With community supported theater, we sort of have this option to say, here, this is what you can get for 9 months. Here's what it costs. Do you want it? And it's allowed me to totally rethink the way that we approach our sort of fundraising campaign in a way. We build revenue for the company. So I think it's healthy for us as theater artists if we don't ask people mm-hmm. for support. But I think some fundamental things need to change in this country and in this city in terms of how theater is supported. We shouldn't be the ones asking people to support us, but there should be organizations asking and governments asking people to support us. That's mm-hmm. I think what I.
It is. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating because we're supposed to be presenting this product to everyone that everyone wants, and some of us are, but we mm-hmm. can't force people to come. We have to be shameless self-promoters.
Well, you're fighting against the popular perception that independent theater,
right?
Great, sign me up.
So many people don't know what it is. So many people, and it's like I said, it's really risky. People work hard for their money. We work really hard for our money. So spending an evening, you know, at a show that isn't enjoyable, or it's one thing if you just don't like it, like, oh, I didn't like that, but if it's badly done, it's really hard. And
it's not a charitable act to see theater, or at least it shouldn't be.
That's true.
And I've gone on my soapbox about this many times in many public forums, but I really do think that the less that we as theater makers can think of ourselves as charities, and the more we sort of think about ourselves as other models, whether it's as small businesses or as one of my favorite Obi-Wan director named John Clancy, he said that theater is a vice, so it should be thought of like casinos and prostitution and drug deals. But I think approaching these other models helps us pull out of this really sort of poisonous charitable atmosphere.
Gus, would you agree?
Well, I think what's being said here about you know, the play is the thing, and why can't it be enough is an absolutely valid question, ask. You know, and I think part of the reason is, well, it's not enough. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not a sustainable model, or at least not for the kind of work that I'm necessarily interested in doing. You know, Broadway's been doing some great work lately, but there's just other work that I'm interested in doing.
Yeah, of course.
And I know that there are audience members out there who are interested in seeing different kinds of work. So you know, if it's not just going to work as a product, you know, then what else is there? And I think that's the question that we're all asking. I wanted to come back to something that was being talked about earlier, which is this idea of sustainability. You know, I think one of the problems that we're facing across this country is the deals that have been made to ensure sustainability. You know, there's a lot of regional theaters right now that feel really constrained in terms of their programming. I mean, it's almost like they're held hostage by their audience in terms of the work they want to do. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There was this promise of governmental support, the Ford Foundation, that just didn't come through. And so there's this regional theater movement sort of left out to dry, you know. But at the same time, you always have to ask yourself, why does our sustainability matter? You know, I don't think it's a bad thing that these theater companies necessarily fold after one production or after 4 years, you know. I mean, that's what theater is. You do what you can to make the work that you need, you know, and if it turns out that the work that you need to do demands a degree of sustainability, then you need to make sure you have exactly that much and not more. Because as soon as you cross over and you make the sustainability of the institution the goal, it's no longer about making great work. Yeah, you know? And
I think that's absolutely true.
Absolutely.
I just caught a marathon weekend at an American Repertory Theater in Boston because one of Stolenchair's members was in one of a trio of pieces that they're doing up there. And Diane Paulus just took over the American Repertory Theater this year. And they have a very, very... So they are an experimental subscriber base insofar as they're a Cambridge audience, very, very educated. They like their theater, European and avant-garde. And and what Diane Paulus has come in and done, she's brought in three productions that are inspired by the stories of Shakespeare. First things first, you're not going to get any Shakespeare text. Mm-hmm. I think whereas other regional theaters have been challenged with how to bring more adventurous work to their theaters, Diane's Paulus's challenge was how to bring more populist work to her theaters. And she had these three shows that were running in repertory with each other. And it was amazing to walk around the streets of Boston and Cambridge, to go into any coffee shop and hear people talking about Sleep No More, hear people talking about The Donkey Show, hear people talking about Best of Both Worlds. And she's proven, I think, that that you can go ahead and say, you know what, subscribers, you can come with me on this journey, or you can go find another theater to support. She's shown that she's really not bound by that. And I'm sorry to be speaking for you, Ms. Paulus. But no, I'm
sure she's a listener.
I'm positive. But I do think it's whether you like the work or not, it's very, very courageous to say, you know what, blue hair subscribers are not as important to me as hip Boston University students speaking in coffee shops.
Right.
And I'm going to take that risk. And I think it's really, really interesting to see that that's happening, that that some people are saying, okay, I don't have to be beholden to the subscribers.
I wondered if each of you could kind of speak to, well, two things, actually. One is, I guess, why New York? And also, where do you see the company going ultimately?
I think New York, I think what brought most of the people that are involved in Wide Eyed to New York is what New York produces and the respect that New York has everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can be a hostess at a restaurant for a year and then move to Denver, Colorado and get hired as a hostess anywhere you go because you did it in New York.
Yep. Yep.
And it's the same with acting on stage in New York. You can go to any community theater or any professional, you know, regional theater with your resume that says, I did all of this independent theater in New York, and it bodes well for you. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason a lot of people came here. And of course, because these are where opportunities are. I think a lot of it is the respect factor. It's also the hardest place in the world to do anything. And that's why you get that respect factor. People know that.
Yeah.
And it's the most expensive, and it's such a huge volume of theater and so much competition. It's amazing. As far as where Wide-Eyed is going, it would be really great if in some reasonable amount of time we could get to a place where we sustain ourselves and where we can make the commitment to pay our artists everything that they deserve and become a respected institution, you know, that people know that if they're going to see a Wide-Eyed show, at least it will be high quality, and at least they'll know that we put everything we had into it and all our resources. And that's really what we're all about, and I think we're on the right track. So we're productions because we don't want to just do theater all the time. There are fine artists and film artists and lots of different people who come to us and say, "Do you do this?" And we want to. So hopefully we'll find a place where we can do everything that we want to do and sustain ourselves doing it. That's really the goal.
Yeah,
I'm gonna make the New York question very, very reductively simple and say that while it may or may not have been the most prudent thing to start in New York, the fact of the matter is the survival jobs that I have, which sustain me and make it possible for me to spend as many hours working on Stolen Chair as I do, I could not as easily get in outside of the New York metro area.
That's an excellent point.
And so I sort of rely on that. And I have not been to all the cities in the world that I'd like to, but of the cities I've been to, New York is certainly one which buzzes with constant inspiration for me, even if I'm trying to fight it. In terms of where Stolen Chair sort of sees herself going, we really hope this community-supported theater thing becomes the development playground for all of our new work and becomes the revenue source for all of our development. I think we're hoping that over the course of the next half decade, we can gradually fully fulfill our mission to be a laboratory theater instead of being a producing company, and to make sure that we have relationships with the presenting orgs in New York and surrounding areas where we can say, hey, in about a year, we're going to have this cooking up. Who wants it?
Yeah.
And I know that's a sort of vainglorious aspiration, but that's ideally the position we'd like to be in, where we are spending all of our resources cooking up this new work and then finding opportunities to allow other people to present it and produce it, because we don't want to put all of our energies into that. We want to put it into the development, and we want to put our investment into the members of our community-supported theater who are developing it alongside us.
Me. Okay. why New York? Well, I love New York. I just love this city. I don't want to live anywhere else, which is hard because I really do believe in a lot of the things that Scott Walters, who, if you are don't know who that is, listeners to this podcast, he's got a blog called Theater Ideas and a blog called Less Than 100,000, 100K, which is really all about the fact that you can't have truly national support for a theater without having an actually national theater. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that, and I want to support it any way I can from New York, which is a contradiction, but then I really like contradictions. in terms of where I would love to see the company, we have an annual retreat. We've been very lucky. Bill George, who is the founder of Touchstone Theater Ensemble, has a retreat called Little Ponds Arts Retreat. We've been out there 4 years now. And it's this beautiful farm in the rolling hills of Pennsylvania. It can house up to 18 people, big, beautiful rehearsal room. And we've been there every year during the summer to sort of ask questions of why New York, why each other, you know, look at the values, look at the aesthetics, and continue to develop the work we're going to produce. And this last time, we made a timeline that was, I think, at least 20 years. And it was actually a string that we put on the wall. And you were allowed to put a certain number of our artistic goals, a certain number of personal life goals, number of goals for the company itself. And you're supposed to string them along where you thought they might fall in the course of the company's life and your own life. And boy, was that fascinating.
I can imagine.
And so for me to say, I would like Flux to be here, I just have to remember that image to realize that I have no idea where Flux is going to be, because there's a lot of other people in the company with very strong visions.
Right.
That said, this last production, The Lesser Seductions of History, convinced me that we do need to move towards a level of resources where we can pay our actors more, and where we can have previews, an extended preview run. Because the developmental workshops that we've done have not been enough. The work that we do frequently, the technical elements are really involved, and you just don't know. And I feel like we did a really good production that could have been a great production.
Gotcha.
If we had had 2 weeks of previews.
It was a great production.
Oh, thanks. you know, but I think that's the right reason. You know, I think the reason of, I know that a lot of audience members walked out of that production legitimately moved and changed, and all the things that I want theater to do to me and to them, but a lot didn't. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we could have had more if we'd had those resources, you know?
Right.
So that moment where, you know, the audience member leaves and you can see that they're not going to talk for the next 20 minutes. And that's a good thing.
Yes. Yes. Know? Yes.
I want to be able to create that in as many, people as possible. And to do that, we need a little bit more resources to be able to give the artists who are part of this company the chance to fail and mess up with all of the elements present, learn from it, and really make a great production. So that's a short answer to a very long question.
Right. Well, if I could just say I admire all of your work very much, and I hope that the podcast helps in some small way to help you take the next step towards your respective visions. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen, the theater panel on the Road to Shambhala podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Your personnel were, once again, Ms. Kristen Skye Hoffman of Wide Eyed Productions, Mr. John Stancato of the Stolen Chair Theater Company, and Mr. Gus Schulenberg of the Flux Theater Ensemble. Hope you enjoyed hearing from them as much as I enjoyed talking to them. Let's all get out there and see their stuff if you too are a theater head. I will see you there. And I will also see you, hopefully, on the next episode of the Road to Shambhala podcast, which will be out next Thursday. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning us in. And don't hesitate to let us know what you think. It's shambhalaradio@gmail.com or 909 Shazaps on the telephone. So I hope your New Year's is wonderful, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.